You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa, no mai, hari mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. It's just me in the studio today. Soph's off on a lovely holiday in Nam, so I hope she's having a wonderful time. But this is the first time I'm paneling by myself, so bear with if things aren't like as smooth as normal, but I'm sure it'll be so sweet. But if I akene coming up on the show today, so I've had a korero with historian of sex, gender and health in late 12th century Aotearoa and Australia. She'll wear about her latest novel, Untold Intimacies, A History of Sex Work in Aotearoa, 1978 to 2008. I had a korero with Alex Laurie about his current show, Knit, on at Grace. And I also had a chat with Tessa Walker-Elliott about her show on Being Image on Now at Window Gallery. E aha o whakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsuhi mai, you can text us on 5395-5355-5355. Wai mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Also, after the show, you can catch all these pieces and more by podcast on the 95BFM website.
Oh, that's a good art!
Untold Intimacies, A History of Sex Work in Aotearoa, 1978 to 2008, is a new book written by historian of sex, gender and health, Cheryl Ware, published by Auckland University Press. In June 2003, New Zealand became the first country to decriminalise sex work. Through the lived experience of 25 individuals, the book is an account of the stories of sex workers in Aotearoa and the industry's transformation over the critical 30-year period. Drawing on new and archival interviews, Ware tells their stories through an in-depth historical investigation from the regulation of brothels with the Massage Parlors Act of 1978, through the struggle of decriminalisation to the legally mandated National Review of the Law in 2008. Sophia had a korero with the author Cheryl Ware about the importance of this body of research, writing the book and her reflections now.
I've always been interested in the histories of gender, sex, sexuality. And I did my PhD over in Sydney with gay men living with HIV. And again, it's the 1980s and 1990s that I'm really interested in. Some of them talked about being involved in the sex industry and the complexities, I guess, of navigating what we now know as safe sex, or what, you know, was becoming known as safe sex. And with clients, and also some of them finding clients even more receptive to the use of condoms than they found their partners in their private lives. And that was a topic that I was really interested in, and I wanted to kind of move back to when I moved back to New Zealand. I started this as a history focusing on from 1978 with the Massage Parlors Bill to 2008, and so it captures all of that period. And of course there's a lot of complexities with New Zealand being often held up as a world leader for women's rights and sex workers' rights, but also having the most, one of the highest rates of domestic violence in the world and everything like that. So those were all these issues I really wanted to tease out.
And you kind of signalled at it there, but this feels like a very important body of research, particularly as Aotearoa was the first country to decriminalise sex work. Why do you think an examination of this part of Aotearoa's history is so important?
That is a great question. As an oral historian, we focus on these kind of big narratives and these narratives that we tell ourselves within these kind of, I guess, national narratives, for want of a better word, that prevail. And so we really, some scholars have said that considering New Zealand was the first country to where women won the right to vote, it was inevitable. That it would be the first country to decriminalise sex work.
Mm.
I think it's really important to revisit this history, because under that story, sex workers are kind of presented as people who merely benefited from these more progressive attitudes towards sex and sexuality. Mm. From the late 20th century, we have the women's rights movement, we have the gay liberation movement, you have all of these social movements bringing attention to inequality, but that tends to overshadow the significant impact that individuals had in making law reform happen. It wasn't an inevitability.
Mm.
It passed by a single vote. It's something that people have been fighting for, sex worker activists had been fighting for, since the year I was born.
And I feel like with that, there's a lot of kind of stereotype challenging and myth busting that might come with this body of research. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, for sure. And it's something that that sex workers themselves I interviewed were really keen to do as well, and really challenge, as you said, those stereotypes that prevail. And some of the, I was asked previously about one of the most powerful stories I remember, and it is someone who talks about her dad's support when she came out to Ms. Whakawahine, and how her success, she credited her success in the industry to the support he gave her, the morals that she grew up with. And so really, it's really the our kind of living sex work as a continuation of these important values, about these ideas that it's really important to respect people and everything like that. And that is really contrary to some of the negative public ideas that prevail about sex work.
And this time period that the book examines, 1978 to 2008, has been called a critical 30 years for the history of sex work and its transformation in Aotearoa. Why examine this period specifically?
I like a question because it gives me a chance to kind of talk about why it's so important. I was always interested in the 1980s and 1990s, and I guess because as a historian for the last 10 years I've been focusing on the HIV and AIDS epidemic, and that's a chapter in the book as well. But really finding those key points, and so I've bookended it by the Massage Parlours Act of 1978, which brought attention to, or which meant that massage parlours were public spaces, so police could go in without a search warrant and masquerade as clients, and then go back to arrest the worker if they'd offered or simply agreed to extras, and allegedly sometimes even if that hadn't happened. 2008 is the legally mandated review into law reform. And so I felt that it was either ending there or in 2003 with law reform. But I felt going the extra 5 years would give me a chance to capture some of the immediate aftermath of decriminalisation.
Clearly 2003 would have been a major turning point in this history, and I understand this is a loaded question and, you know, the premise of the book in a lot of ways, but I guess I'm kind of interested in what some of the key changes from this were. How did legalising sex work change the nature of the industry for workers in Aotearoa and beyond?
Oh, in a lot of ways. One of the most significant ways people talked about was the relationship with the police. And so knowing that it was no longer criminalised, knowing that they felt that they could go to police for help, of course. And Lindsay Armstrong, the criminologist, has written about this a lot, where law can't entirely transform those relationships. There's still going to be individual police and there's still going to be a power imbalance there. But what it does is it kind of creates a situation where sex workers have rights, and they have rights under the law. They have rights to be protected by employment legislation, and it meant that, so there was definitely the police, the employment legislation, and interestingly, sex workers were already paying tax, and so that wasn't the change that some people thought it would be, but it really transformed it. It means that they can operate their businesses with that safety.
Tell me a bit about the scope of this book. It's such an extensive body of research. How did you kind of structure that from start to finish for the reader to take people through this history?
I focused on the key themes. And so at the heart of the book is the 25 interviews.
Mm.
And I structured the book around the key themes that emerge across the testimonies. But in terms of how you take it through, it kind of moves from setting up the introduction of the Massage Parlours Act, and then moving through to the increasing visibility of sex work, the importance of mental health and community, and then going into sex workers' health and safety. Consent was a key one, and body autonomy, because again, that's challenging all of these stereotypes and these ideas that if you, both for people within and outside of the industry, if you consent to sex in one instance, then that's blanket consent. And it's really fighting against those. The final chapter is called Reflections of Work, and that is a way of, that really brings us up to 2008 and beyond, and offers a reader the chance to have a look or engage with how people reflect back on their time in the industry, given all these really significant changes.
I can imagine this research process would have been a very personal relationship with the people you interviewed and talking about their life experiences and reflections. How did you kind of navigate some of the complexities of this process?
It was personal in so many ways, so many ways. And so, of course, those relationships with, and I'm so grateful for the people who opened up to me, who either had done interviews with other people and agreed for those to be shared with me, or who gave me their time and we would chat. Most interviews went for a few hours about some really, really intimate and really personal topics. On top of that, I was going through my own personal changes. I've just come through back to New Zealand after 5 years living overseas. It was my first time revisiting New Zealand history. We had the COVID pandemic. I had my two children during this time, and so there was a whole lot going there. And navigating all of these changes and all of these relationships wasn't always, I was going to say, smooth. It was, I guess, because I was going through a lot of change myself and my own, I guess, feelings about academia as well. That was just another factor there, but the key thing was having a really strong support system. And so I'm part of a Wahine research group, excuse me, and we met monthly and went through our work, and everybody's doing amazing things. One of my friends in the group is writing a history of obesity, the other is writing a history of pregnancy, and so it was being surrounded by this really, really beautiful group of women who are all interested in the same kind of histories, and that was really grounding, really motivating.
I can imagine. For you, what was the biggest takeaway or learning you gained from this research and writing Untold Intimacies, either personally or a factual takeaway as a historian?
The factual takeaway as a historian, it was really just how so diverse, the stories were so diverse, absolutely diverse, and the way the industry operated, all of the connections, all of the, I know I had a lot of respect for the people in the industry before going into it, but when I finished this book, it was really that moment of, wow, you've been fighting for these rights for 30 odd years, because the fight isn't over. The fight didn't end with decriminalisation. Rather, there are parts of the prostitution reform bill that they're still fighting to repeal, such as Section 19, which makes it illegal for people on migrant visas to work in the industry. And on a personal level, it was just such a joy writing it. I found my voice as a writer. I really feel like my soul is in this book.
That's so beautiful and such a lovely way to kind of come to the end of our conversation today. You did kind of touch on it in that last answer, but just before we wrap up our kōrero, did you have any reflections on the state of the sex work industry in Aotearoa now?
I mean, the New Zealand Prostitutes Collective, newly changed its name to New Zealand Sex Work Collective, does amazing work. I think what they're fighting for, what they're still fighting for, their peer-led organisation, and are really, really putting so much effort into working sometimes with police, sometimes with other organisations, to get a lot of education out there to let people know what their rights are. And people have said, again, I'm not someone who's been in the industry. People have reflected on the on how it's you've got a lot more safety being a sex worker in New Zealand, and I mean they are absolutely to absolutely to thank for that, because they really transformed the industry.
That was historian of sex, gender and health, Cheryl Ware, speaking to Sophia about her latest novel, Untold Intimacies, a history of sex work in Aotearoa, 1978 to 2008. Untold Intimacies is available now at all good independent bookstores near you.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We'll be right back. We've got some Sharon Van Etten for you, one of my absolute favourite songs. This is 17.
Hey, this is Phoebe Bridgers, and you're listening to 95B FM.
Alex Laurie is a Tamaki Makaurau based artist working amongst sculpture and installation in response to site-specific and architectural contexts. The title of his current show on At Grace, Knit, is a three-letter homonym referring to 1. The egg or young form of a louse or other parasitic insect, 2. A foolish person, 3. A unit of luminance used to measure brightness. Within Knit, Laurie resumes his long-standing fascination with vessels. A magical sculptural water vessel awaits viewers as they enter the gallery, luring them in closer through its hypnotic circular movements of 5 wooden goblets amongst a bath of milky water. Venturing further into the gallery, a scullery of translucent spoons and ladles quickly shift into these illusionary ciphers that nod to the form of an egg, sinking in and out of their surroundings, refracting the light as they fall between. I had a korero with Alex Laurie about the show and overall practice. Could you start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice, the key mediums that you gravitate towards, as well as the thematic and or material glue of your practice, the thing that kind of acts as a undercurrent between all projects?
Hi, my name is Alex Laurie. I live in Tamaki. I work mostly with sculpture and installations, and the thematic glue, really be grasping here for exhibitions, probably responses to site-specific like architectural contexts, conversations with collaborators, or like maybe examining the supports or so.
Mm.
I'm like often making waterwork. Like it was the beginning of the commission, like Emile's commission for the solo show, that there would be like this element of like biography. I met Emile at Elim, and at that time I was making little fountain things just for fun, and starting off with like really gross ones with lots of liquid nails, glue, and then later searching for a framework to point at like wetness as a freshly completed gesture, or dichotomies of wetness and dryness with activity and static things. So sort of like continued to haunt the practice like that.
Mm. Nice. And I would like to start the conversation around this specific body of work by speaking to the title of your show, Knit. Could you speak to its triple meaning, as well as kind of your relationship to the word? Like, was it something that guided you throughout the making process, or was it something that arose out of it through the making?
I'd say it arose as part of the show development. I offered a number of titles, and Knit like somehow survives the critique, even with its horrible connotations. I was reading this. I was like reading about the mystery genre in fiction, and I just read this short story called The Zahir by Jorge Luis Borges. And the word Zahir is borrowed from Arabic. It's kind of like evident or apparent. And in the story, they describe the Zahir as being this object that has this power to create crazy obsession in anyone who sees it, and it could be like a variety of things. But at the time, it's this 20-cent coin that the protagonist, who's like Jorge himself, gets his change in a bar, and it has the letters N and T and the number 2 scratched into it. And I think this was while I was figuring out what to put into the water, like, I don't know, maybe it would have been a coin, I don't know.
Yeah. And could you run through a bit its three specific meanings? Because I feel like it's quite, maybe not integral, but it really circulates the whole show and its meaning.
Like, I suppose there's this theme of opacity and, like, transparency. Mm. And maybe there's to that, the definition of Knit being this, like, unit for brightness and screens, like, you can say that a TV screen has a certain number of, like, a Knit rating or something.
Mm.
And then the knittiness of it, like the creature of the Knit is like, and I could be like an idea that is like infectious, or like it's sort of like this tiny little like nightmarish affliction that you could have. So maybe it sort of feeds back into itself. And then the foolish, foolish person. I don't know.
Yeah, it's got so many meanings and avenues, which is really interesting. And at the center of the gallery, a magical sculptural water vessel awaits viewers, luring them in closer through its hypnotic circular movements of five wooden goblets amongst a bath of milky water. You have a long-standing fascination with vessels such as ponds, troughs, and buckets. What keeps you circling back to them? And did you find yourself landing on, I don't know, some kind of understanding of them or a shift in path of exploration through the making of the specific work?
Yeah, like maybe this time around, because I've been working with Grace a little bit in the capacity of a like technician, helping with some of the installs and sort of doing that as a job as well.
Mm.
It sort of made sense that I would make the ponds, or you know, the start of this plan with Emil to make a fountain based around that, or fed back in from the project at the Oyster, that we would take parts of the gallery and like feed it back into the show itself.
Mm.
So the sheet in the middle is sort of like a sheet that I would use as a painter's sheet, and used it to refurbish the gallery a bit. And the water itself is like made opaque with the same paint that the walls are painted with. Yeah.
And as viewers venture further, they are led into a gallery of translucent spoons and ladles that quickly shift into these illusionary ciphers that nod to the form of an egg, sinking in and out of their surroundings, refracting the light as they fall between. Could you speak a little bit about this work, some of the conceptual thinking behind it, as well as what the process of making them look like?
Yeah, I like that you saw an egg.
Yeah, that was like one of the first things that I noticed about it, actually.
Yeah, the yellow.
Yeah.
The Perspex journey probably began a few years ago. I was working on a show with Tom Took and Priscilla Rose Howe, and Tom was presenting puppets that he made, as well as these automatons, these little kind of robots. And we were looking at this 18th century automaton called the Silver Swan. Really encourage you to look at it. It's great.
Mm.
It has this neck that moves around and catches a little fish, and it sits on the stream of twisted glass rods which rotate to emulate the currents. And this led to finding this other device that is specifically for puppet theatre, which shines like a lantern or a light through it, and it has similar rods that sort of work like a sunlight emulator. And I was working as a studio assistant at Monmouth Glassworks at the time, so I thought, great, let's make it from glass.
Mm.
But it didn't work out, sadly, and Perspex was the contingency plan.
Yeah.
And in a similar way, the spoons for Grace could be for like generating an atmosphere, I suppose.
And yeah. What are your hopes for viewers as they enter into the space of your show and engage with your work? Are there any little nuggets of thought that you hope that they leave with and kind of mull over?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really resistant to like give direction or apprehend interpretation, but like I do encourage folk to visit. Like the photos are already on the website. It feels like the show is already over, but it closes the top of August. It's been nice that, like, outside they're still working on the road because of the train station.
Mm.
They're kind of doing, like, the most amazing stuff all day,
digging
up the road and, like, kind of demonstrating that the world is kind of, like, constantly being created and destroyed. So there's sort of, like, maybe an element to that. Like, you can walk out of the rubble of the city and then into this, like, half-made gallery and perhaps, like, notice how it's all sort of a bit made up.
That was Alex Laurie speaking to me about Knit, which is on at Grace until the 2nd of August.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
We'll be right back. You're listening to Various Artists on 95BFM.
I'm in love!
Moisturizer, the bold second album from Wet Leg, is out now. Moisturizer is fun, freaky and fabulous. An unbridled display of the live muscle Wet Leg have built up over a few years of non-stop touring. Punchier, prettier and more perverted. Moisturizer is an album of manic love songs and well-timed kiss-offs. Delivered by a clan of the UK's most beloved oddballs. Moisturizer by Wet Leg. Available wherever you get your music.
I just want to say how proud we are. I remember when you were just water, malt, hops, and yeast. They just brew up so fast.
Holy heck, Hallertau's turning 20. To celebrate, the Barons of Beer are throwing a huge family-friendly party on Sunday, July 20th, and a barnstorming adults-only shindig on Saturday, July 26th.
Plus, from July 1st, Hallertau will be announcing a new giveaway every day for 20 days.
Head to hallertau.co.nz or follow Hallertau's socials for details.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show.
Oh, beloved woman of liberty!
2 hours of punk, hardcore, goats, doom, metal and thrash.
The apocalypse on blue, keep me alive!
The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show.
A man reduced
for 11pm to 1am every Sunday night, only on 95BFM.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
Tess Walker Elliott is a Tamaki Makaurau-based artist working amongst analog photography processes. Her practice is centred around engaging with the archive, working across both personal and national archives. Within her current show at Window Gallery on Being Image, Walker Elliott draws on her personal medical archives, engaging with x-rays and ultrasounds to examine the depersonalization of the medical image and environment, pulling the x-rays back into a place of the darkroom photography process, using x-rays as photo negatives that Walker Elliott then layers with external images of her own body, attempting to bring these medical images back into a place of the body, of the personal, resulting in a series of images that wrestle with the dissolving of the external image into their own abstraction through the internal image. I had a korero with Tess Walker Elliott about the show and overall practice. Here it is now. Could you start off by introducing yourself and speaking a little bit to your overall practice, the key mediums that you engage with, as well as some of your central themes that guide your practice?
Kia ora, I'm Tess, and I'm a recent AUT graduate in the Bachelor of Visual Arts program. So my practice is centred around engaging with archives. I work across personal archives and national archives. The work that I've been working on at the moment on Being Imaged looks at personal medical archives, so I've been engaging with x-rays and ultrasound, and my practice is led by my making and is very process-based, so I mostly am using analog darkroom practices and traditional printing practices.
Your show text on Being Imaged introduces viewers to the world of this body of work by speaking to the hand of Anna Bertha Ludwig, the first human x-rayed image. I would like to start this conversation at the same place. Would you mind telling me a bit more about this, as well as the kind of conceptual thinking behind this idea of the x-ray?
So I looked at when x-rays were first discovered, and I came across this incredible image of the first x-ray, which was made by the scientist Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen. And it is a photograph of his wife, Anna Bertha Ludwig's hand. And he was a scientist who was looking more into the use of gases, which then led into kind of radiography. And he discovered it he was working in a dark room, and I don't know the kind of specifics of this physics behind it, but he kind of compressed these gases in a tube and in a completely dark room, and that led off a fluorescent light. And when objects were placed between the fluorescent light and then a photographic plate that was covered in barium plantanocyanide, an image would appear. So it's darkroom photographic printing, basically.
Wow. I think I never thought about it in that way before.
Yeah. So it's a completely, photographic process, which is really interesting. And when he discovered it. I mean, the photo is so beautiful. I think there's a sense of slight movement because in that kind of photography, darkroom and plate photography, you have to be incredibly still. And then obviously there's the added element of it being an X-ray.
Yeah.
So there is the slight movement, which I think is really beautiful in the hand, but also realizing that those X-rays do not move past certain materials such as metal. So you can see her wedding ring on her left hand, on her finger, which I think is, really interesting. But I, discovering this and then realizing that I can use an X-ray as a, similarly as a film negative in the darkroom was, quite interesting to me. But also the fact that we have, a lot of us have lots of records of X-rays of ourselves. If anyone's, had X-rays before and kind of looking at them as self-portraits when I was looking at these archives, and also how they hold time, relationship between time and the body, but also this kind of data that's made in these medical spaces and is kind of almost trapped in that data and statistics. And so I wanted to kind of take them back from that and put them back into the dark room and print them myself. So I guess there's an element of control as well.
Yeah, like bringing them back into the space of a body with this kind of quite laborious.
Exactly.
Vessel. Yeah.
Yeah, like using, your hands, yeah, exactly. Because I think that in those medical spaces there, I've always felt a kind of lack of bodily autonomy in those spaces. So being able to kind of reframe the X-ray and have control, because it is also an image of yourself. So taking it back into the dark room, and the process was really fascinating of putting it in the enlarger and it acting exactly like a film negative, and then that goes back to how they began as well.
It's so beautiful. I always think of X-rays in such a medical environment, even though it like shows, I don't know, like really and like an intimate part of ourself, but yet so not like it. So I think it's such beautiful the way you use it in your show. You briefly touched on it, but these images within your show come from your own personal medical archive to employ this re-imaging of the body, examining radiography's reductive nature as it transforms the body into a cumulative statistic. What led you back to these images from your own personal medical archive, and what was the process like for you dealing with these innately intimate images? Did it shift or like alter your relationship with them? Because I feel like it's something that you don't normally revisit a lot. So how was revisiting it?
I really enjoyed kind of working with them. They do have that deeply personal aspect, but also I think processing the kind of medical experiences by engaging with those materials has been quite, I've really enjoyed doing that and kind of I think that within those medical spaces, those experiences you have are really hard to process and understand. And that kind of makes sense when you look at the history of it in kind of science terms, because the body and the body sensations and feelings are so far removed from the science behind medical imaging. And I was reading a lot of Anne Boyer's work, called her book, The Undying, and she had some really interesting ideas around how the body's sensations and feelings cannot be quantified, and yet they're constantly being asked to in medical spaces. So when someone says, rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, she says, how can I possibly quantify those sensations? And also things like people constantly ask before any treatment, they ask for your name and date of birth so that they know it's, the correct person, but how that kind of depersonalizes you, that repetition again and again. And I think repetition is also something I was really interested in engaging with. So I have prints on the wall and they're just repeated prints, mm. and slowly the x-rays are introduced on top of the body. Mm. And that also goes back to kind of historical photographic processes. I looked a lot at Edward Muybridge's work, which was kind of known as like the foundations of cinema, his motion studies. Mm. And he was actually asked to work on motion studies because someone wanted to know whether a horse's tread, they had all four legs,
yes,
on the ground.
I think I've seen this. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting. And so I was kind of influenced by that, the idea of the repetition of the body. And then by introducing the x-ray, a sense of movement is kind of introduced as well. Mm. But it's an internal movement, I guess. Yeah.
And do you feel like looking at your work on the walls compared to the original archive x-ray thing, like, is there a shift in relationship with it? Like, are you looking at the wall, like, do you feel more personally connected to the ones on the wall?
Definitely.
Show, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Mm. I feel like maybe some medical, or those experiences feel more resolved or mm. more kind of... maybe I have a better kind of understanding, and then all the reading I've done around it has been a really great way to kind of understand a lot of it. Because, yeah, I've also looked at, yeah, Anne Boyer also talks about, she has this amazing quote which I have in my writing about mm. how a person's body made of feelings and flesh is turned into a patient made of light and shadows in the mm. x-ray.
You draw on methods of darkroom printing, screen printing, and projection, all of which employ light or its complete absence of, materializing these images in the form of silver gelatin prints that deal with both the internal and external images of the body, that push against each other and dissolve the personal, bring it into their own abstraction. Could you walk me through the material process and the creation of these works?
Yeah, in the darkroom, I take a film negative, it's a self-portrait of my upper body, mm. and I expose the image in an enlarger and then develop the image. And so when you see my prints, as I kind of mentioned before, there tends to be one to two prints are just of the body without an x-ray. And then I introduce the x-ray in the darkroom. So I expose the image of the body and then I put the x-ray in the enlarger, similarly to how I put the film negative in an enlarger. And I expose that same piece of paper that I've exposed the body to, I expose it to the x-ray, and so this is done in complete darkness, and I haven't mm. developed the body first or anything. Mm-hmm. So I develop them together, and I never really know where the x-ray is going to be placed in terms of the body, because it's quite difficult in the dark to kind of marry up, or you can't yeah. see the previous image.
Yeah.
I mean, I could technically, if I wanted to be really precise, I probably could figure that out, but... Yeah.
No, but I think that's where, like, the magic happens in art.
Yeah,
that, like, that element of like unpredictability.
Yeah,
and, like, what it—I don't know—what it wants itself to be, or what it's like demanding of you. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, definitely, because I think when I was doing it, I did quite a few because I didn't know where they were going to be placed and if it was going to feel like it was in kind of correctly placed. But it was really exciting because, you know, when you're in the darkroom, you never really know how your image is going to appear until it's in the developer. So each time it was in the developer, it was quite exciting because I didn't know where the x-ray was placed. And then you kind of know which one is right. You just, I think when it started to become unclear which part of the photo was the x-ray and which part was the body, which shadow was shadow of the body or shadow of the x-ray, that's when I felt like it was kind of right. The screen printing process, I actually started on my laptop, so I overlaid an x-ray and one of those scanned images of the body and just overlaid that. What's really interesting about screen printing is it actually is very, or the type of screen printing I do is photographic as well, so I'm actually exposing the screen to an image similarly to a darkroom. So I guess with screen printing is you need that transparency, so when you look at the screen into the light it is transparent, which goes back to, I guess, x-rays and all the materials which have an aspect of transparency.
And also included in the show, we've got this moving image on these sheets of metal. Can you speak a little bit to the inclusion of those?
Yeah, so that moving image piece is my own personal ultrasound video that I've slowed down with an archive video of, I used to be a competitive dancer, and it's one of my competition days as a dancer. So I overlaid the ultrasound with that video and kind of looking at the internal and the external. So the internal, I think ultrasound is amazing because it's actually recorded by sound waves, which is really incredible. And there's this amazing movement that you get in ultrasounds, this kind of expanding and contracting that mirrors the dancing that occurs in the video.
Yeah.
So kind of internal dance of the organs with an external. And I was also kind of interested in the ideas of performance and performance in medical spaces, how often feels like during the testing you are kind of undergoing some kind of performance of sorts. Even the lighting, the kind of bright lights and things like that. The space that you're being in, it feels very surreal in both circumstances, the kind of unreal, non-real.
And how do you wish for the show to be experienced by viewers? Is there anything that you hope that they take on or feel with after engaging with the works in the show?
Yeah, this subject maybe is not necessarily talked about because it is extremely personal. I don't know what I expect people to feel necessarily, but I guess I am kind of interested in pulling it out of those contexts and seeing how people engage with it.
That was Tess Walker Elliott speaking to me about her current show, On Being Imaged, which is on now at Window Gallery until the 6th of August.
Because we were feeling a little extra, a little conti.
Gorgeous. We've now got some Reb Fountain up for you. This is He Commands You to Jump into the Sea. Enjoy.
Under us, follow me. Interested.
Gorgeous. We played an extra little song for you just then. That was Cherry Pie by Phaser Days. Now we're going to head into the Arts Guide.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists. It's paintings and that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Untold Intimacies, A History of Sex Work in Aotearoa, 1978 to 2008 by Cheryl Ware, via Auckland University Press, is available now at all good independent bookstores near you. Also as mentioned on the show, Knit by Alex Laurie is on at Grace until the 2nd of August. And On Being Image by Tess Walker Elliott is on now at Window Gallery until the 6th of August. Ma, an exhibition curated by Yuka Oshinesi, is on at Arts House Trust at Pa Homestead until the 31st of August. The Camellia Society, an exhibition by Karen Montgomery, is on at Object Space until the 24th of July. Memoration, an exhibition by C. Rong, is on at Sanderson Contemporary until the 20th of July. Tala Oteo is an exhibition by Angela Tiatia, and Yuki Kihara is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 30th of August. Now I'm a Wall, Now a Window is an exhibition by Saskia Leake on now at Ivan Anthony until the 19th of July. Peter Robertson and Giorgio Griffa dialogue exhibition, Differences in Kind and Rhythm, is on at Te Uru until the 24th of August. If you have something you would want to put on the Arts Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's all for us on various artists today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us. Cheryl Ware, Alex Laurie, Tess Walker Elliott. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com. Up next is The Land of the Good Groove. And I'm Maya. And that was various artists. We'll catch you next week. And you're listening to 95bfm.com. Oh, not .com. You're listening to 95bfm. Thanks, have a lovely day. Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.